Okay, my name is Joanne Carlson Brown, and I'm the pastor at Tibbetts United Methodist Church in West Seattle, and an adjunct professor at Seattle U in the School of Theology and Ministry, and I teach church history there, and one course a quarter or so, and no more, because the quarters that I teach, it's a job and a half, because I do have a full-time church. And we are at the last of our heretics. The Donatists, and I wrote it up there. And for once, I don't have any handouts because we don't have anything from them. We have what people wrote, like I could have given you the really huge treatise that Augustine wrote against the Donatists, but nobody wants to read that. It's really long, and there it is. The question really for today, I mean, we've had different questions on or different emphases on what was going on. The question for today is your little Latin lesson for the day is ubi ecclesia. Ecclesia,
church,
ubi, where? Where is the church? And in fact, we had in one of our many moments of making fun of things, we made a crest. A Latin crest, because we had all these private schools and we were at a public school, and so we made this crest that said ubi, semper ubi, sub ubi. Always wear underwear. And people would go, semper ubi, sub ubi. Just, so it's always wear underwear. But it sounds really, really classy in Latin with that. But it's ubi ecclesia. Where's the church? Who makes up the church? What is the church with that? And before we get to the actual Donatists, we have to do just a touch of history beforehand with it. And that is to be, and the Donatists and the whole controversy around the Donatists is in North Africa. Again, if you recall, Montanists were in North Africa, and Pelagius ended up in North Africa for a while. Arguing with Augustine. So North Africa really was a hotbed of theological conversation in the Roman Empire. Long time, the bishops of Carthage were really very powerful, and Hippo, which is what Augustine was, but they're all, that Northern Africa is just teeming with theological debates and understandings all the way from Tertullian on. And so it's just interesting, and then it gets kind of lost when the Muslim invaders come, and that center, really vital center of Christianity, disappears with that. But in there were a number of persecutions. We have visions that the early church was constantly being persecuted, and that's actually not the case. There were really very sporadic persecutions, and they happened every once in a while, and they would last for a couple weeks, couple months, then it would end, and everything would go back, and people would, and then it would pop up again, and somebody would decide it was time to persecute the Christians again. In 248, so mid third century, a wealthy ex lawyer became bishop of Carthage. His name was Cyprian, and this is the history part, because you have to understand what Cyprian does before we get. And Cyprian, true to form in a lot of what happened in the early church, and I know people that are going through the ordination process right now that would just kill for the speed with which this this went. Though he had been a Christian for only 2 years, he had shown his devotion to the church by selling some of his estates before baptism and giving the proceeds to the poor. And after baptism, he also sold some of his gardens for the same purpose, though friends bought them back for him. He soon became a deacon, then a presbyter, and then he was elected bishop.
2 years.
In a little less than 2 years. I mean, he was a Christian for 2 years, and then immediately, boom, 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 right along there with it. By the Christian people of Carthage. At that point, the bishops were being elected by the folks or at least in North Africa, they were farther away from Rome, where they were getting appointed. They were being elected. And he was confirmed in his position by the neighboring bishops over the opposition of that was organized by five presbyters in the city. So there were five presbyters that weren't really happy that Cyprian was going to do this. During the short time before the Decian persecution, which was sort of in that 1260s, he occupied himself with maintaining discipline within the church. He even forbade an actor to practice or to teach dramatics. Acting was not a thing that you wanted to do for a long time in the Christian church with that. And he denounced the common custom of spiritual marriages. And spiritual marriages were two people, mostly a nun or a monk or priest, would agree to live together, but that they wouldn't engage in sex, but they would have a spiritual marriage. And nobody believed this. and so he denounced the practice of spiritual marriages as well. When the persecution began in the city, he left the city ostensibly to maintain his administrative work. He said, you know, if I'm here, I'll be persecuted. And they said, I need to leave so I can make sure that everything goes smoothly. Well, there were a lot of people that said, yeah, right. You're just doing that. And he said to avoid endangering others with that. This step aroused much criticism, although, as he pointed out, his property was confiscated. Well, he'd given away most of his property, so it wasn't that big a deal. In Easter 251, Cyprian returned to Carthage and held a synod on the matter of the lapsed. And the lapsed were the people that cooperated with the persecution in some way. So usually what happens when the persecution would come is that they would say, okay, you have to sacrifice to the emperor, but sometimes if you had enough money, you could bribe somebody and you could purchase what was called a libelli, which was a letter that said you had sacrificed to the emperor. So you didn't really sacrifice to the emperor, so you really didn't do it, but you bought a letter that said you did, and so therefore people would leave you alone. Or there were people that really did sacrifice to the emperor. They also wanted them to hand over the holy books and the holy relics of things. And some people did do that, but a lot of people, because the Roman soldiers by and large couldn't read, and so they just hand over, you know, a math book. they really didn't give away anything that was Christian. But still, there was the thing that you cooperated with the persecution, and it saved you. And so there was a whole range of the lapsed, from buying letters to really sacrificing to really giving books away, holy relics and stuff, or not really giving anything but giving something. So you saved yourself. Or there was the being arrested and executed. Because you wouldn't do any of those, doing any of those things. So all those people that did cooperate in some way or somehow were called the lapsed. And so Cyprian had to figure out as a bishop, what do we do with these lapsed people? Because remember, at this time, there really isn't all that much forgiveness after baptism. They don't have a penitential system developed yet. So during this time, he writes a treatise on the unity of the Catholic Church, where he really argues that we have to hold the church together somehow, and we have to figure out how to do that and hold it together as one big unity. He's one of the first people to argue for Peter, the Petrine, superiority in the bishops. But then later on, he has a controversy with one of the popes named Stephen, and he changes his mind and says, no, all the bishops are equal now. But he's trying to figure out a way to hold the church together and it was a pastoral kind of thing with that. In the spring of 252, another persecution seemed to be impending under the new emperor Gallus, and a council of 42 bishops met at Carthage on May 15th. Their letter now readmitted all the lapsed who had continued to be penitent, though they had to get readmission through their bishop. So it depended on if their bishop felt like letting them back in. And they had to be truly penitent, and they had to show that they were truly penitent, and then they could be readmitted. And this is an important aspect of that you're readmitting the lapsed folks in there. Then there's persecutions that break out in 253, 254, and 256. Again, they're sporadic, and it depends sometimes on who's proconsul, it depends on who's the emperor. Then there was an outbreak of persecution in 257 that brought the controversy to an end for the moment. Under the first edict of persecution, Petronius, the proconsul of Africa, simply banished Cyprian from Carthage. He read the edict. Cyprian read the edict and refused to comply with the edict. He replied that he was a Christian and recognized no other gods, though he added that a Christian supported the emperor and his government by his prayers. Petronius gave Cyprian an opportunity to retract his answer, but the bishop remained firm, so Petronius inquired about the presbyters in Carthage, and Cyprian refused to give their names. Petronius read the provisions of the edict, which forbade the meetings of Christians and their use of cemeteries, because really what he was trying to do was to destroy the Christian organization. So if you can't get together, can't bury your dead, can't do anything, then things. So Cyprian is banished. 11 months later, a new proconsul allowed him to return home. But then on September 13th, 258, he was arrested. And he was brought before Galerius Maximus, and has this whole, there's this whole exchange. I've got a copy of the transcript of the, that somebody wrote down of the trial, and it says, you are Theseus Cyprianus, I am. You put yourself forward as the leader of these men of sacrilegious mind. Yes. The most sacred emperor orders you to perform the requisite ceremonies. I will not do it. Consult your best interests. Do what you are ordered to do. Galerius Maximus sentenced him to death by beheading. Cyprian was led away to execution, surrounded by a military escort, including tribunes and centurions. He was taken to the Augur Sexti, which is the kind of field, it would be the sixth field, and a large valley that surrounded by trees. There was an immense crowd. Cyprian covers his eyes with his hands and urged the executioner to perform his task, and he becomes the first martyred bishop in Africa. And though Cyprian's theological ideas, as expressed in his writings, are not unimportant, his primary significance for the history of Christianity lies in his moderation and in his administrative skills. His views on the lapsed, largely shared by the Roman Church, kept the Church from becoming a sect. Because if you, in fact, excluded everybody who just didn't have enough courage to be a martyr, then the Church would have lost, there wouldn't have been anybody left. And the people that were left were dead. or a very small group. So he really did keep the Church going in his moderate understandings. And by this time, North Africa was being Romanized as well, particularly in the pushing for the primacy of Rome and the Roman bishop as the pope at this point in time. The synods become looking like a senate structure, the church really begins to imitate the Roman government in how it's set up and structured. But he also, Cyprian is really a very strong moralist, and we've seen this with Pelagius, we've seen this with the Montanists, really strong moralist kind of folks. And he admired Tertullian, and he talked about liberal almsgiving was commended because good works cover sins after baptism. They don't quite forgive them, but they cover them. After baptism, as baptism itself provides forgiveness for previous sins. So see, these folks are still trying to deal with what happens if you sin after baptism. They just don't have an understanding or any kind of theological understanding yet of what they're going to do. Cyprian wrote 81 letters and 12 treatises and provided a really clear picture of the Christian life and thought in Africa between 248 and 258. So it's important to know a little bit about that history of dealing with the lapsed, because when we get to a little later, we're going to get to these folks who are going to say, oh no, that was such a bad idea. And again, the question, ubi ecclesia, it's the prime question. Where is the church? Who is the church? Who makes up the church with that? The nature of the church. Are only good people to be recognized as members of the divine society? Or does it include the imperfect as well? Is the church a museum for saints or a school for sinners? Which is kind of what it came down to. And so the Donatist controversy begins around 313, which is kind of ironic because that's when Constantine wins at the Milvian Bridge and stops the persecutions. But now it's all the question of what do we do with all these people that did all this stuff during all these persecutions beforehand. And Cecilian was elected bishop and consecrated by what they called a traditor, or a traitor. Felix of Aptunga. And he had actually probably given holy books to the soldiers when they came. And so not only was he lapsed, but he really actually did do something. And so they referred to him as a traditor. This revived this old controversy that Cyprian had dealt with about 60 years beforehand about what you do with the lapsed. And the African church had taken the line that sin destroyed the office of the minister and so invalidated his sacraments. Whereas Rome and the rest of the West generally held that only a sentence of deposition could deprive an ecclesiastic of his charisma, or the holy oil of the Holy Spirit that was descended on him.
So are you talking about the sin of the practitioner?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Again, some of the Donatists were no doubt seriously perturbed by the thought that the church seemed to be conforming to the standard of the world. And again, we see this in almost all of those heretical movements. They, you know, the church is compromising with the world. We need to be pure. We need to hold ourselves to kingdom values, not worldly values. And so the Donatists were like, you know, you are conforming to the standard of the world. And they were genuinely anxious to preserve its high ideals. It's probable that for this reason, they claimed for themselves the proud title, the Communion of the Saints. A title which the church speedily claimed as more appropriate for herself. So they said they were the Communion of the Saints, and the Orthodox Roman Church said, nope, that's us. We're the Communion of the Saints. You guys don't get that. There were all kinds of imperial investigations and councils, and then the movement really becomes a social movement. I mean, we were talking about whether there were politics and some of the other things that were in there. In North Africa, there are three different ethnic groups. There were the Berbers, who were the kind of native peoples in North Africa, and they were pretty much the lower class of folks with that. And then there were the Punic-speaking population that were descended from the ancient Phoenician pirates and settlers, and they lived mostly in the coastal areas. Of North Africa. And then, of course, there were the Romans, who had pretty much conquered the land and were the most recent arrivals. And they lived mostly in the fertile coast areas, but they really ruled the entire region. And they had a lot of different estates and things that were pretty much run by slaves, which were primarily Berbers. And in fact, the Donatist church services were held in Berber, not in Latin, with that. And so it became the rising of the poorer section of the population against the landowners. And the native section against the dominance of the Romans. With that, there was a really radical group of Donatists called the Circumcellions, and they were like really violent folks. They had clubs that they called Little Israels, and they would come swarming over the hill onto an estate, a Roman estate, and beat the proverbial substance out of anybody who didn't want to go along with their understanding of what should happen. And really, part of the problem is that there is a bishop that is elected in Carthage, and after the election, in the usual pattern, other bishops came and joined to consecrate the new bishops, and there were no questions raised about the person who was elected, but some people said that one of the consecrating bishops was unworthy to carry out the function. And so the problem is that they said, if in fact the person carrying out the sacrament has sinned, it invalidates the sacrament. So this new bishop of Carthage really wasn't the bishop of Carthage because he hadn't been properly consecrated by real Christians, which means that everything else that he did afterwards, ordaining priests, carrying out the sacraments, baptism, Eucharist, was invalid. Anything that those priests did who were ordained by those particular bishops were also invalid because they were the fruit of the poison tree, so to speak. If you watch Law and Order, you can't do that. So it was throwing everything into chaos about whose sacraments are valid, and particularly with the Donatists, it's whose baptisms are valid. When I was taking a course in seminary, we had to do presentations on these various groups of folks, and we were assigned, unfortunately, I was assigned Augustine against the Donatists. And one of our, I can't remember, I wish I could, because seminary was so long ago. We wrote a song that we sang, and all I can remember is the chorus, God in heaven, all the saints preserve us from the Dunkin' Donatists.
Where's the word Donatists?
Donatists is the leader of the group. Most of these come from the name of the name of the person.
What was his relation? Was this Cyprian, the bishop that got beheaded?
He was later. Yeah, he was later.
Later.
He's about 60 years later. Okay. So I did the Cyprian thing to show you that it's been an issue in North Africa, and it was kind of settled that, you know, if you repented on your deathbed and you were truly repentant, you got a deathbed forgiveness. If you really had lapsed, there was a question about whether you were ever going to be forgiven. But Cyprian was still willing to forgive some people. So the Donatists come along and say, nah, really, not really, really can't do that with that. And the person that they come into major conflict with in this controversy is Augustine. In about 411, and it's the whole doctrine of the church, what Augustine wanted to stress was unity and holiness and Catholicity, small c, Catholicity, which is universal, means universal, represents all classes and all people, and its apostolic understanding, so that it gets its authority from apostolic succession.
So
with that.
So it's similar for like 100 years, from like 313 up to 411?
Yeah.
It just keeps
simmering. And Donatists is long gone.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time Augustine starts writing against these folks.
For quite a period.
And it's been going on since the mid 3rd century, quite frankly, with Cyprian. And even before that, it was a question of what do you do if you sin after baptism? And they never really came up. It's not the Celts are the first ones to come up with a penitential system. And they write a handbook on what the penalty should be for each sin. It's, I mean, they outlined every sin they could possibly think of, and what the punishment should be. And there,
when was that?
That was about 6th century. And they come up with this penitential that then started to spread with it. And so it provided, because they saw that there was, you know, seriously, people sin after baptism. They just do. And if you're not going to let anybody, if you're going to kick them out of the church, again, what's going to happen is you're going to get a little sect and not a universal church. And so these folks are trying to figure out, how do we make this a universal church? And one of the things that Augustine argues is that he's very clear, along with all these other folks, that outside of the church there is no salvation. Now, for the Donatists, the definition of church is very small. It's the pure. It's the people who have not sinned. The people who have not done any of the lapsed-y kind of things that you could do. For Augustine, the visible church was everybody. You cast out your net, and you pulled everybody in. And there were good fish, and there were bad fish, and there were wheat, and there were tares, and it's not ours to judge. That comes at judgment day. That's God's business. Our business is to get everybody in. Because if they're not in, then there is no salvation. So you got to get them in. And it led to some people talking about the difference between the visible and the invisible church. That the visible church was everybody. An invisible church, however, was those folks that really were saved. But we can't tell who's in the invisible church. And there are some people in the visible church that are not in the invisible church. And there are some people that are in the visible church, the invisible church, that aren't quite in the visible church yet, because they haven't heard kind of things. And part of this gets into the election understanding, that you can be elect and not be part of the visible church, because God has determined this somehow, some way, with that. And Augustine's doctrine of ministry advanced beyond Cyprian's. Holy orders were now described as belonging rather to the individual rather than to the office that he holds. And they are a personal matter rather than an official possession. Thus, a person who has been validly ordained to the priesthood is still a priest, even though for a time he leaves the church. And if he returns, no further ordination is necessary to enable him to resume valid functions. So even if he lapses and he comes back, he's still a priest. Because it's in the same way the sacraments that he administers as are independent of his moral character. So he could be an absolute raging sinner, and because he's a priest, the sacraments are still valid with that. Because Christ himself is the true minister in each sacrament. So that it cannot be rendered invalid by the character of the minister, who is his properly accredited agent. So as long as you were properly ordained in the way that you were supposed to by a bishop who's been having the apostolic succession, then whatever you did was valid. Now, for the Donatists, their doctrine of the church is that there is no salvation outside the church, but it's outside the bounds of this small body of African elect. Since the remainder of the world had accepted Cecilian, which is the bishop that had been ordained with that. And persecution and martyrdom were to be expected as the mark of the Church of the Spirit. So if you're not being persecuted, you're not doing something right. You know, if everything's going along really swimmingly, no, not so much with that. But for Augustine, the greatest sin that he saw that anybody could engage in was schism, separating the church. And so the Donatists were schismatics. They were separating from the church. And for Augustine, that was the greatest sin that you could possibly engage in. And that the sin of schism was a lack of caritas in its grossest form. Caritas, Augustine talks about two different kinds of love. See, the English language is just paltry. We have one word, love, and it could mean a bazillion things. The Greek have three, really nice. You know, we've got eros, we've got which is sexual love. We have philios, which is brotherly love or brother and sisterly love, and agape, which is selfless love. With it, it's great. You know, so you can determine which kind of love you're talking about. In Latin, there's two. There's cupiditas, which is self-love, which is where we get the word cupidity in English. And it usually has a sexual connotation to it, but really is self-love. Caritas is where we get the word charity, and that's selfless love. So when, for example, the King James Version translates 1 Corinthians 13, it's translating it from the Latin Vulgate, which is using caritas, and that's why if I have not charity, instead of if I have not love. But it's in Latin it was love, but they translated it as charity with it in the King James. With it, so schism for Augustine is the lack of caritas of selfless love in its grossest form. And any attempt to overcome this difficulty, first by paying elaborate homage to the excellent grace and humility of Cyprian, pointing out that not even the baptismal controversy did he break communion with Stephen, but then going on to indicate the fallibility of his doctrine of the sacraments by implication of his doctrine of the church. And it wasn't too effective for that. They say, you know, we're not really breaking, but, you know, you've got to do it. And Augustine agreed with Cyprian that there was no salvation outside the church. But I said it's wider, and it's this visible church that you cast the nets. One of Augustine's arguments against accepting the fact of Donatism had been that religious liberty was merely a liberty to err, to make a mistake. If you had religious liberty, you were going to make a mistake. People left to their own devices without the threat of church and state coercion were bound to make the wrong choice. And it's against the Donatists that Augustine comes up with two of the really horrible things that the Christian church has adopted all the way through the rest of his history. One is the just war theory. And the other is religious coercion. With that.
Is it inevitable, do you think, coming out of it?
When you have Augustine's argument, you can't do anything else but. Because really it's kind of the ends justify the means. Because he really does believe outside the church there is no salvation. So you do whatever you need to do to get these people into the church, even if you are forcing them into the church. And he's the only writer, he's the only early church writer to discuss this subject, religious coercion, at any kind of length. Unfortunately, when we get to the Reformation, we will see all kinds of people understanding that this is exactly what one needs to do. And the Catholic Church picks it up, too. I mean, that's why we have all these, the Inquisition and all these heresy trials all the way through the Middle Ages with that. And the way he justifies this over and over again, biblically, is the forcible conversion of St. Paul. That he uses the scene of divine violence, what he referred to, extensively. And Paul is knocked off his horse, and you know, and Jesus appears, and then he's blind and he's led. And so, I mean, Saul doesn't come to his own understanding and say, oh yeah, really, wanting to be Christian would be an excellent idea. He's forcibly converted. And so Augustine uses that and says, see, that's what God uses. Sometimes people need to be forcibly to do that. And that the Christian emperors for Augustine unquestionably have the right of coercion. That's their job as good Christian emperors. is coercion. Strict legal sense, to punish, restrain, repress those impious cults over which God's providence had given them dominion. And he does this from this kind of prophetic viewpoint, so that somehow, that some knew why history was happening, and the church had to be diffused throughout all the earth, and therefore, and be a universal church, therefore the emperor has every right to coerce folks into what they're doing. And then people said, well, what do you do with the problem of what they called ficti, or false confessions? Because some people say, oh, yeah, Christian, and with their fingers crossed with that. And he said, well, you know, we have to leave the problem of the ficti to God. You know, somebody says they're a Christian, okay, fine, they're in the church, we don't bother them, and God will sort it out. And if they're one of the elect, they'll get in, because he really does have this understanding of predestination and election with that. For Donatus, Augustine's arguments, attitude to coercion, is a blatant denial of the traditional Christian teaching. God had made people free to choose good or evil, a policy which forced this church was plainly unreligious. And they quote some of the same passages that the Pelagians will quote later about this. And the reply, Augustine, was the same answer. The final individual act of choice must be spontaneous, but this act of choice is prepared by a long process which people did not necessarily choose for themselves, but which was often imposed on them against their will by God. It's what Calvin's going to refer to later on as irresistible grace. For Calvin, there is no free will. You know, we're all easing our way down to hell in a hefty bag. And all of a sudden, grace zaps you, and up you go. There is no little leveling off point where you can say, well, I think I'll have grace today, or maybe not today. Once grace hits you, it's irresistible, and up you go. And that is Augustine's understanding, that that yes, people can choose, but it's not spontaneous. They're led to it through a process, and oftentimes forced into it by the grace of it's a little weird understanding, but you're forced into it by the grace of God, against their will, mind you, by the grace of God. And again, quotes St. Paul's conversion for this. And then he talks about discipline, that there has to be discipline within the church. And essentially, it's an active process of corrective punishment, a softening up process, a teaching by inconveniences. It said that the Old Testament, God taught his wayward chosen people through just a process of disciplina, is what he refers to it as, checking and punishing their evil tendencies by a whole series of divinely ordained disasters. And so that's, you know, God's way God acted towards God's chosen people. God continues to do it. That's how we get them in. The persecution of the Donatists is just another controlled catastrophe imposed by God, mediated on this occasion by the laws of Christian emperors. And in Augustine's mind, it was no more than a special instance of the relationship of the human race as a whole to a stern father who would, quote-unquote, whip the son he receives, unquote. And indiscriminately enough at that, it's kind of like a man who comes home and beats his family every Saturday night, just in case. With that, the law imposed on the Israelites was imposed on them by force, compelled by fear into the covenant, and fulfilled an important function to deter Jews from the worst sin of polytheism, when spiritual unity of the church emerged. And because of all of that, then because fallen men and women need restraint. Remember, Augustine is going to be the big original sin guy. And so fallen people need restraint. And that's the church's job, and it's a Christian emperor's job. And so you get wholesale persecution and forcible coerced conversions of the Donatists. And then, but to do this, he also does the just war theory with that. And just war is just a really quite interesting understanding. Augustine says, under what conditions Christian can use force. First, you have to be invaded. So you can't be a proactive war. It has to be reactive. It needs to protect civilians and only fight other military units. And it's a last resort. And it's this is my favorite part of just war theory, it is conducted in such a way that love for enemies remains. And so his argument for using this just war against the Donatists was that the Donatists had disturbed the internal peace of the empire and therefore had invaded the empire. And then we could use this just war with that. And so we get this whole, I'm just saying what the Donatists do is that they sometimes forcibly, but they rebaptize people. Because they start with this one bishop who was not ordained properly. They look at all the priests who did all the sacraments, and so all the people that were baptized by those priests are not really baptized. And so they would rebaptize them, but that's not what they understood they were doing. They understood they were baptizing them for the first time, validly, because their previous baptisms were invalid. And so they're called rebaptizers. Interesting things was going to happen is that this 5th century law against the Donatists is going to be resurrected during the Reformation and used against the radical reformers who are rebaptizing because they only have believer's baptism. And so they'll resurrect this ancient 5th century Roman law and use it, not just the Catholic Church, but the Lutherans and the Calvinists are going to use it against the radical reformers, and it depended on how you wanted to die, who you got caught by, whether you wanted to be burned, drowned, or beheaded. That was your choice, particularly for radical reformers. They're referred to as, I don't use the term because they didn't understand themselves that way, but the term is Anabaptists, and Anabaptist means rebaptizers.
Would we recognize any of the names of these?
Menno Simons, the Mennonites. The Mennonites, the Hutterites, Baptists, folks that became Baptists, but probably Menno Simons is probably they were a loose group of folks. They didn't have one of the more looser groups in the Reformation. They didn't have one leader like Luther or Calvin. Menno Simons was probably the one of the stronger ones, but there was the Schleitheim confessions where they came in. And did that. They were also pacifists, which didn't help any in their cause in the Reformation, because nobody trusted them. But it is an ancient. Again, what happens is all these wonderful ancient heresies keep popping up. With that about whose sacrament is valid against the Donatists, Augustine comes up with what becomes the official doctrine of the Catholic Church, even unto today. Ex opere operatum, which means the sacraments work in and of themselves. It doesn't depend on the faith or the purity of the giver, and it does not depend on the faith or the purity of the receiver. Grace works in and of itself. That comes through the sacraments work in and of themselves, which led to some really interesting debates among the scholastics in the Middle Ages about what happens if a mouse nibbles the host. Because it's already consecrated, it works. in and of itself, does that mean the mouse is saved? or has received grace? And it's just, I mean, and I can't tell you how many years they spent debating this question. But this is in response to the Donatists saying that the person who does the sacrament has to be pure. And also the person receiving it has to be. And so then Augustine comes in and says, no, really, the sacrament works in and of itself. Because it's not Christ. As I said, Christ is the one who really is the minister of the sacrament, not the priest. And so that is the official position of the church, yet and even unto today. With that, and it's a classic definition that comes from Augustine in his argument against and with the Donatists for that. But then the question was the Donatist baptisms valid? And the church said no, because they weren't properly ordained, they weren't properly given the position. And therefore, you have to be validly ordained, and you have to have the correct elements for a sacrament to work. Yes, they work in and of themselves, but they have to be done by a properly ordained priest. And they have to be, so for communion, it has to be bread and wine. I don't know what they do with us Methodists these days with the grape juice thing, but you know. And baptism has to be done with water. It's the essential element. Which then leads, quite frankly, to the wonderful argument that Pope Paul VI made in 1976 when he declared that women could not be priests because they did not bear a natural resemblance to Jesus. Therefore, the essential bit to be ordained a priest, the essential matter to be ordained a priest, clearly, was the dangly down. And I was in seminary at the time, and Rosemary Ruther, I don't know if you know who Rosemary Ruther was, she's a Roman Catholic, feminist theologian, really.
She
quite
would have been bishop or pope or something if women
were. Yes, she would. She's an amazing theologian. Her probably one of the most accessible books that she's written about feminist theology is Sexism and God Talk. But she loved to doodle. She was my advisor in seminary, and she loved to doodle. And when this statement came out by Pope Paul VI, she drew this picture of a priest guy standing there with the Basilica of St. Peter's hanging from his Peter. and it was just really funny. And I was like trying really hard not to laugh because we were in a very serious place. And then she decided she was going to design new vestments for the priests so that they were trench coats. So at the appropriate time during the service when you were going to concentrate, you flashed the congregation to prove that you were valid to do the sacrament. with that, I remember we were at, it was right after the Episcopal Church had voted to ordain women in 1976. And we were at a banquet where Rosemary was the major speaker, and her husband couldn't go, so she asked me, and I'm like, sure, free dinner, I'm so there. And we were sitting there, and across from us were some really high Anglo-Catholic Episcopalians who were clearly upset about this decision. And they were going, and they were like right across from us at the table at dinner. There's women sitting right across from them. And they're saying, where can we go now that Mother Church has abandoned us? Can we go to Rome? Can we go to the East? And Rosemary, without even putting her fork down, said, I don't care, why don't you just go to hell? and just kept eating. I'm there. She had this incredible wit. She also had a capacity to reduce you to about this big verbally. Which she would do if she was not happy with you. I used to go, she had no social skills at all. And I used to go around sort of smoothing things over. I was her graduate assistant, and she would speak and offend everybody. And then I would go, what she really meant was. Because she didn't care. She was oblivious to the effect she had on people. With that, so But so the Trinitarian formula had to be used, and the person performing it had to intend to do what the church does, and so that makes it valid, and you really can't repeat it with it. And so the question really comes, and it's come in some of the other places that we've looked with the Montanists, and with the Pelagians, is how pure does the church have to be with it? And how sinful can ministers be before their unworthiness invalidates their actions? And it's a question that comes up really in a very contemporary way with all of the priests and the sexual abuse and misconduct stuff, where there are people that are beginning to ask the question again. Is what about all these priests that have done this? What about everything that they've done? Are you really married? Are you really, because there's seven sacraments in the church, and so that covers that, you know, that covers everything. And the church is not budging on this. They're still saying ex opere operatum. It doesn't matter. But there are some folks that are saying, how sinful can the priest or the minister be and still be a valid member of the clergy? And the question is why we're not, a number of these folks then, defrocked with that.
Now, my limited understanding of ex opere operatum is acts that priests did as a priest stand as valid
yes.
acts. Does that doctrine itself prevent someone from being defrocked and not
no.
performing valid sacraments in the future?
If they're defrocked, then whatever they do...
Then the church still maintains it as the authority to defrock.
To defrock people, yes.
But still, their past acts...
But their past acts were valid.
Yeah.
As long as they were validly ordained a priest
and
used the proper formula and used the proper elements... What they did before is valid.
The church could remain faithful to this and still be more aggressively in
yes.
action.
Yes, right. And so part of it is to say that if in fact you are behaving in a very sinful manner, we will replace you.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my particular denomination, I'm a United Methodist. The minute someone is accused of sexual misconduct, they are immediately pulled from their church. And then there's a whole trial and investigation and things. And we do remove people's ministers' credentials. And therefore, then they can't perform any of the sacraments again. But it doesn't invalidate anything that they did beforehand with it. It's why the Catholic Church recognizes Protestant baptisms, where they may not recognize some of the other things that Protestants do. They recognize Protestant baptisms because they're done with the triune formula, and they're done by validly ordained,
or sort of
validly ordained. But you won't find a Catholic priest that will rebaptize a Protestant, somebody who was Protestant. They have to go through the whole RCIA training and stuff and be confirmed in the Catholic Church, but they're not going to be rebaptized. And that comes, again, from this Donatist controversy. But it does raise some really interesting questions about how pure does the church have to be? Is it, as we said, a museum for saints? Or is it a school for sinners? And we have a number of these heretics that we've been looking at all week that really want to push for more purity. And you hear that, I think, more and more preached from a number of pulpits of talking about that we need to follow kingdom values and not worldly values, that we need to be different. People need to be able to tell. I used to say that people shouldn't have to ask me if I'm a Christian. They should be able to tell by the way I act and what I say. partly I live in the Pacific Northwest, which is the most unchurched area of the country. And people don't make that automatic leap. They just think you're a nice person. And so what I'm trying to train my congregation to do is when somebody asks them, well, why are you so nice? Or why did you do this? To say, I only did what any follower of Jesus would do. I said, and then leave it at that. You don't have to ask them if they're saved. You don't have to ask them, you know, anything. It's just, you know, just a simple, make the connection for the people, because they're not, in at least my area of the country, are not going to make that connection. You need to make that connection, and then just leave it go. They also have folks carrying in their pockets, I hope, and in their purses, business cards for our church. It has the name of the church and the website and the time that it meets and things. And I said, carry them with you. And if you're in a conversation, you're in a line at a grocery store, and somebody, you overhear somebody say, you know, I'd go to a church if I could find a church that wasn't condemning of gay and lesbian people. You can say, I go to a church like that, hand them the card, and invite them to come. So that's it. I'm not talking about any big evangelism kind of tour, but there is a sense wherein Christians or people that are followers of Christ, followers of Jesus, should be different because they are following the teachings of Jesus than other folks. That's not to say that other folks are not cannot act in a good and moral way. I know plenty of people that are humanists that are really quite wonderful. But it's also, that's what sustains us in doing the acts that we do. I was really involved in the anti-war movement in during the Vietnam War, and the people that maintained their work on that were the people that were church connected. They were the ones that didn't get burned out because they had a reason why they were doing it. They were doing it because of the love of God, and that one loves God and one loves God, one loves your neighbor. One loves your neighbor. And there was a sustaining part of that, whereas some of the folks that were doing it, because it was a really good idea at the time, burned out. They had nothing to sustain them with that. So while we're not going to the extremes, say, of the Donatists, there is a sense that there should be something different. Should be something different about us. There should be... We have a way that, and when we don't, then there is a great disappointment in it. It's the personal affront I feel every time I hear a clergy person accused of sexual misconduct. I feel like it reflects on me. That somebody is going to say, "Well, you're one of those. You're a minister." And I'm like, "Yeah." And people who say, how can you possibly be involved in this patriarchal, homophobic, judgmental, hypocritical church? And I'm like, yeah, it's not all like that, you know? Yeah, there are some people that are just, you know, we would really like to go somewhere else. but, you know, we'll in that sense, the other thing that has lasted is that it's a wide net. Is that you cast the net and you bring everybody in, and it's not ours to judge. The Donatists are really clear, it's theirs to judge with it. That's a lot of things I don't agree with Augustine with, but that's one of them, that you cast out your net and you bring in as many, not coercively, but bring in as many people as you can into the community, and it's not for us to judge whether they're good enough to be with us or not, whether they're dressed properly, or whether they smell bad, or maybe they're a little drunk when they come to church. There's ministry to be done in that, in helping people to turn their lives around sometimes, but you can't do that if they're outside, if you don't bring them in to the life. So and even though Augustine uses religious coercion to do it, we can do it out of love and not a coercive kind of thing. So... Those are five, if you were here all week, those were five different folks that made an impact on the church, all labeled heretics, but we got some good stuff out of them, I think, and can recover some things from them. Not everything. I can understand why except maybe Pelagius. I can understand why everybody was, you know, folks get condemned as heretics, but there are things that we can learn from them and recover from them. There are some things that the Orthodox Church just really got wrong.
I just can't help but think that the hinge point in all this is Augustus. And to me, he's not a follower of Christ. He's the Antichrist.
He has some really good things to say. But as I said, I think I said yesterday, the man should have died 20 years before he did. And then he wouldn't have written. His later stuff is the stuff that's really, really strong into predestination, really strong into original sin, really strong into condemning a lot of folks. And he's not the only one. Every single early church writer wrote a treatise against the heresies. It was like an assignment. But Augustine does absolutely has more than anybody else has shaped not only the Catholic Church but the mainline Protestant Church as well.
But this idea that he gives the power to the emperor or to the Habsburgs, and to me that's what caused First World War.
Yeah, it's you know, and partly we're a little prejudiced because we have the separation of church and state thing that nobody else has. In fact, it was one of the reasons why the Anabaptists or the radical reformers were persecuted, because they held for a very strong separation of church and state. Thank you all so much for your patience and presence.